This is Audible.
Simon & Schuster Audio presents The Age of Eisenhower, America and the World in the 1950s, by William I. Hitchcock, read by Arthur Mori.
For my father, David I. Hitchcock, Jr., who was there? Prologue. When I think about Dwight Eisenhower, wrote Captain Edward Beach, Jr., Eisenhower's naval aide, I like to recall an incident that took place aboard the presidential yacht Williamsburg shortly after he was inaugurated for his first term in 1953. The Williamsburg, a steel-hulled vessel of 1,800 tons, had served as President Harry S. Truman's pleasure craft. He used it for cruises with friends and political cronies. In May 1953, President Eisenhower ordered it decommissioned. He thought the ship frivolous and wasteful and felt it should be used for recreation by GIs who had been injured in the Korean War. One evening, the president met the ship at the dock in the Washington Navy Yard as it returned from a cruise on the Potomac. As Eisenhower boarded the Williamsburg, he stepped in among the soldiers, brushing aside his Secret Service guards with words to the effect, "Just let me be for a while. I know these men." Captain Beach remembered the scene. The soldiers crowded in around him. They were young men whose bodies had been ravaged by war in some way. Some lacked an arm or a leg. Some hobbled on crutches. Others had heartbreaking facial disfigurements. They gathered as close to the president as they could get, and I heard him talking to them. This was an Eisenhower that the public never saw. He talked to the soldiers of love of country and of sacrifice. He said their country would never let them down, but no matter how much it did for them, it was nothing compared to what they had done for it. And then he said that even with all they had already given, they must yet be prepared to give more, for they were symbols of devotion and sacrifice, and they could never escape that role and its responsibilities. Beach never forgot the electricity of Eisenhower's presence and the impact it had on these wounded warriors. His voice had a deep, friendly warmth, with a somewhat different timbre than I had ever heard before. He reached out and grabbed the men around him, so that they kept crowding in closer and closer as he talked, as if an unseen magnet were pulling at them. Historians who study Eisenhower know how those men felt in his presence. "Ike draws you in." He radiated authenticity, idealism, sincerity, and charisma, and these personal qualities were the keys to his political success. Between 1945 and 1961, no person dominated American public life more than Eisenhower. He was the most well-liked and admired man in America in these years, and he was also the most consequential. This book argues that the era from the end of the Second World War up to the presidency of John F. Kennedy deserves to be known as the Age of Eisenhower. Such a claim would once have prompted chuckles and even sneers from historians, journalists, and politicians. From the start of his active pursuit of the presidency in 1951, right through 8 years in office and for a decade after he retired to his farm in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, critics styled Eisenhower as a lightweight, an amateur, an orthodox, pro-business, do-nothing president, a lazy leader who, despite all his grinning, was often callous and distant, more interested in golf than governing. The Washington Press Corps depicted him as unimaginative, slow-witted, out of touch, and frankly uninterested in the daily affairs of the country. Even as the nation enjoyed a period of unprecedented prosperity at home and a stable, if fragile, peace abroad, and even as the American people grew ever more fond of Ike, His political rivals were scathing about his shortcomings as a leader. It is the central paradox of the Eisenhower presidency that a man so successful at the ballot box and so overwhelmingly popular among the voters could have been given such poor marks by the political class. His critics never grasped the profound appeal of the man and never appreciated the depth of his political talent. His two-time opponent for the presidency, Governor Adlai Stevenson of Illinois, mocked Eisenhower as dim and tongue-tied and declared him little more than a tool of wealthy right-wingers. President Truman, campaigning on Stevenson's behalf in 1952, went further. He told whistle-stop audiences across the country that Eisenhower had only a military mind and that voters should send Ike back to the army where he belongs. The radical muckraker I.F. Stone, writing what many liberals felt, predicted that Ike, a rather simple man who enjoys his bridge and his golf and doesn't like to be too much bothered, would be a president in absentia. Even after his resounding triumph at the polls in 1952, Eisenhower still learned nothing but scorn from his critics. "Poor Ike," Truman said on his way out of office. "It won't be a bit like the army. He'll sit here and he'll say, 'Do this, do that,' and nothing will happen." His presidency changed few minds among the commentators. A 1958 book by journalist Marquis Childs described Ike as a captive hero, a man unable to make decisions, passive, complacent, little more than a ventriloquist's dummy who mouthed words prepared by others. That same year, the New York Post's Washington columnist William V. Shannon drew up a balance sheet and concluded that Eisenhower had largely sustained the policies of his Democratic predecessors in both the domestic and the international realm, and had made almost no major initiatives of his own. "The Eisenhower era," he wrote, "is the time of the great postponement." Norman Mailer, the novelist, was nastier. In a celebrated 1960 essay in Esquire that hailed the nomination of the youthful and energetic John F. Kennedy for president, Mailer derided Eisenhower's era of security, regularity, order. The 1950s for Mailer was a time when many a mind atrophied from disuse and private shame. Mailer struck a note that has continued to reverberate ever since in some circles. "Eisenhower's 8 years have been the triumph of the corporation, tasteless, sexless, odorless sanctity." With Eisenhower's departure from office in 1961, critics gleefully got out their spades and began to bury the ex-president. On the eve of Kennedy's inauguration, New York Times journalist James Reston wrote an essay on the Eisenhower years that read like an epitaph. "Eisenhower was not in tune with the worldwide spirit of the age, which was convulsive and revolutionary. He was merely a good man in a wicked time, a consolidator in a world crying for innovation, a conservative in a radical age, a tired man in a period of turbulence and energetic action." Scholars agreed. In July 1962, Harvard historian Arthur Schlesinger Sr. published the results of a poll that asked 75 historians to rank the presidents. Eisenhower placed 22nd out of 31 chief executives, nestled between Chester A. Arthur and, incredibly, Andrew Johnson. President Kennedy himself had a good chuckle about this. After all the adulation and public frenzy, Eisenhower would not see how he stood before the cold eye of history, way below Truman, even below Hoover. Indeed, Kemmel had almost killed Ike. Not only did Kennedy run a brilliant campaign for president in 1960, contrasting his youth and dynamism with the septuagenarian Eisenhower, but his tragically shortened life only enhanced the sense of his sparkling singularity. Arthur Schlesinger Jr., who had served as special assistant to JFK, rushed out an elegiac account of the Kennedy presidency. In his 1965 testament, A Thousand Days, Schlesinger used the complacent Eisenhower as a foil to better reflect sunlight upon the glittering years of Camelot. In every respect, the comparison between the two men and the ideas that inspired them was unflattering to Eisenhower. By the time of his death on March 28, 1969, at the age of 78, Eisenhower had been largely forgotten by the press. Obituaries summed him up as a worthy man whose greatest role had been played on the European stage in the Second World War, and whose presidency was a postscript to a life of noble military achievement. The New York Times asserted that as president he had governed effectively through sheer force of his popularity among average Americans. A distinctly backhanded appraisal. Time magazine commented that many Americans would remember Ike not as the 34th president, whose stewardship may long be disputed, but as the soldier of peace, who led the greatest alliance of armies the world has ever seen. By the close of his years in office, Time concluded, he was more figurehead than president and out of touch with his people. As a politician, Eisenhower seemed destined to be written off as a benign mediocrity. Tides, once having ebbed, always come back in. The revival of interest in Eisenhower began in the late 1960s, prodded perhaps by the deep national crisis that his successors, John Kennedy, Lyndon Johnson, and Richard Nixon had confronted and exacerbated. In an era of student protest, war in Vietnam, racial upheaval, and economic malaise, the 1950s began to look curiously alluring. One of his most acerbic critics, the shrewd New York Post columnist Murray Kempton, penned a 1967 essay that almost single-handedly gave rise to a new school of thought about Eisenhower. He was neither benign nor mediocre, Kempton concluded, but malevolent and brilliant. His skills ran not to governing, but to manipulation, dissimulation, and guile. He sought ways to profit from the success of others and to avoid the taint of any failures, especially his own. Eisenhower was cold, immoral, determined to conceal his marvelous intelligence from admirer and critic alike. Kempton summed up Eisenhower's political motto, "Always pretend to be stupid, and when you have to show yourself to be smart, the display has the additional effect of surprise." The theme of a devious and effortlessly political Eisenhower appeared in Gary Wills's masterful 1970 study of the early Nixon, in which the Great One was the perfect contrast to the restless, insecure, and nakedly ambitious Nixon. The relationship hinged upon Nixon's desire to supplant Eisenhower, and his awareness that he never could. Eisenhower's supreme self-confidence, his immense popularity, his ability to compel others to serve him while never appearing to ask for such loyalty, all these were mysteries of character Nixon could never hope to understand, let alone emulate. Eisenhower, Wills believed, had the true professional's instinct for making things look easy. He appeared to be performing less work than he actually did, and he wanted it that way. An air of ease inspires confidence. It was in Nixon Agonistes that a leading intellectual of the era first called Eisenhower a political genius, a far cry from the smirks and chortles of the Camelot clan. The picture really began to change, though, in the late 1970s when the voluminous archives held at the Dwight D. Eisenhower Presidential Library in Abilene, Kansas, became available to scholars. In a 1982 book titled The Hidden Hand Presidency, political scientist Fred Greenstein added depth and detail to the sketch offered by Kempton and Wills. Drawing on new evidence, Greenstein argued that Eisenhower's apparent aloofness and absenteeism had been part of a deliberate governing strategy. Greenstein believed that Ike hid his abilities and his own engagement with the issues in order to exercise power more effectively. He used intermediaries to do his political dirty work, baffled reporters with garbled syntax, refused to publicly acknowledge political rivals by name, delegated responsibility to cabinet secretaries, and fed the public reasoned, calm, simple bromides about the American way of life. Eisenhower went to great lengths, Greenstein concluded, to conceal the political side of his leadership. A hidden Eisenhower, then. Perhaps. But later work, drawing on much more material than Greenstein could access, suggested otherwise. During the 1980s and 1990s, the boom in Eisenhower studies gained momentum, sustained not principally by biographers but by historians of U.S. foreign relations. Scholars who wanted to know about the origins and course of the Cold War, the Korean War, the rise of covert operations and the CIA, grand strategy and nuclear weapons, American policies toward China, Latin America, Europe and the Middle East, the rise of the Third World, all trekked to Abilene to inspect the Eisenhower archives in hopes of finding hitherto unseen treasures. The subsequent cascade of studies on Eisenhower's Cold War policies shattered forever the myth that Ike was disengaged from the running of government. And it became increasingly difficult to sustain the idea that he hid his power and authority. The Eisenhower era suddenly looked, well, interesting. The new research revealed a complex president who at times showed exceptional restraint in the use of America's power, but who also had a taste for daring and even recklessness, especially when ordering the use of covert operations against left-wing governments. The documents portrayed a deeply engaged leader struggling to forge policies in a vast array of fields, from civil rights to economic policy, infrastructure, science and education, religion, communist subversion on the home front, and national security policy abroad. Eisenhower now appeared principled but adaptive, ideological at times but usually pragmatic, a problem solver who dominated his cabinet, the military, and the bureaucracy, and put his imprimatur on the age. Above all, the evidence showed how hard Ike worked over 8 years. The allegation that he had been a golf-playing no-show was deeply unfair. "No man on earth knows what this job is all about," he said one afternoon in 1954. "It's pound, pound, pound. Not only is your intellectual capacity taxed to the utmost, but your physical stamina. It wasn't so easy after all." This book stands on the shoulders of the many previous Eisenhower scholars who have worked diligently for years to unearth the secrets of the period and to flesh out our understanding of the man and his era. It also benefits from many newly declassified documents that have become available only recently, thanks to the efforts of the dedicated staff at the Eisenhower Library. Taking into account all this material, this book offers a comprehensive account of the president and his times, and concludes with a decisive verdict. Dwight Eisenhower must be counted among the most consequential presidents of modern American history. Eisenhower shaped the United States in at least three lasting ways. First, he dramatically expanded the power and scope of the 20th century warfare state and put into place a long-term strategy designed to wage and win the Cold War. This book deals with national security and foreign relations a good deal, because Eisenhower spent much of his time forging a global role for the United States. Unlike the isolationist faction in his own party, he believed that to defend freedom and liberty at home, Americans would have to defend these principles overseas as well. These views did not lead Eisenhower to seek war. On the contrary, he ended active hostilities in Korea, avoided U.S. military intervention in Indochina in 1954, deterred China's military adventures in the Taiwan Straits in 1955 and 1958, compelled Britain and France to reverse their ill-conceived invasion of Egypt in 1956, and even established stable personal relations with the Soviet leader Nikita Khrushchev. Eisenhower worked hard and successfully to keep the peace. His global strategy required the steady accumulation of immense national power and a willingness to deploy that power when necessary. Building on the legacy of Truman, who laid the foundations of the Cold War state, Eisenhower deployed American economic muscle, diplomatic leverage, generous deliveries of arms, and a global nuclear shield to deter and intimidate America's enemies. He mobilized science, universities, and industry to boost American military power, even going so far as to take the first steps in the militarization of space. He presided over a significant expansion of America's secret intelligence agencies and ordered them to conduct covert operations and coup d'etat around the world. He frequently evoked the image of an America in peril, and in so doing generated an enduring national consensus to support his robust Cold War policies. Eisenhower built the United States into a military colossus of a scale and lethality never before seen, and devoted an enormous amount of the national wealth to this effort. Biographers have often hailed his tight-fisted budget policies, but when it came to national defense, he was not stingy. In the Eisenhower years, the United States spent about 10% of its GDP each year on the military establishment, a higher percentage than any peacetime administration before or since. This book offers abundant evidence that the man who warned later generations about the military-industrial complex did a great deal to build it. Second, Eisenhower recast domestic policies by strengthening a national consensus about the place of government in the lives of American citizens. Before Eisenhower, the political pendulum had swung from the arch-conservative nostrums of William Harding, Calvin Coolidge, and Herbert Hoover, to the bold, all-encompassing activism of Franklin Roosevelt and the New Deal. Eisenhower, perhaps the least partisan president of modern times, sought to stop the pendulum in dead center. To be sure, when he ran for president in 1952, he thundered against the statism of the New Deal and its expansive federal programs. But once in office, he adopted centrist and pragmatic policies that fairly reflected the preferences of most of his fellow citizens. Early on, he made his peace with the New Deal, expanding Social Security, raising the minimum wage, and founding the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare. He even suggested ideas for a national health insurance system. Eisenhower found a way to make government work without making it too big. His interstate highway system is a good example. Though building its thousands of miles of roads cost billions of dollars, most of the money came from user fees in the form of a gas tax used to replenish the highway trust fund. The burden on the U.S. Treasury was relatively minor. In confronting the greatest social and moral challenge of his times, the civil rights movement, Eisenhower, like many white Americans of the era, responded with caution and wariness. Crucially, though, he did not obstruct progress on civil rights. Instead, he channeled it along a path that aligned with his own ideas about managing social change. Knowing that he was out of his depth on such matters, he accepted guidance from the most consequential cabinet officer of the decade, Attorney General Herbert Brownell. Together, these two men worked quietly through the courts to weaken Jim Crow segregation. They appointed five moderately progressive jurists to the U.S. Supreme Court and ushered the Civil Rights Act of 1957 through a skeptical Congress. The act was a landmark only because it was so rare, the first civil rights law since Reconstruction. Eisenhower took an enormous risk, and one that was deeply uncharacteristic, when he ordered federal troops to surround Central High School in Little Rock, Arkansas, to ensure that court-ordered desegregation proceed despite the hostility of local authorities. It is true that Eisenhower never publicly or personally embraced the fundamental demand of African Americans for equal justice, but he did use his power to aid rather than halt the work of a courageous generation of civil rights crusaders who were just emerging onto the American scene. Third, Eisenhower established a distinctive model of presidential leadership that Americans, now more than ever, ought to study. We might call it the disciplined presidency. Raised in a strict and frugal family and trained for a career of soldiering, Ike believed that discipline was the key to success. Not only did he apply discipline to his own person, maintaining his weight at a trim 175 pounds, and quitting a four-pack-a-day cigarette habit overnight, but discipline infused his governing style. Coming into Truman's disorganized and improvisational White House, Eisenhower imposed order on it, establishing clear rules of procedure. Each Monday he met with leaders from Congress. Wednesday he held his weekly press conference with the print, radio, and, after January 1955, television reporters. Thursdays, he chaired the National Security Council. Fridays, he met with his cabinet. Truman did not convene his NSC often, and Kennedy simply dismissed it. Eisenhower, by contrast, endowed the NSC with enormous importance. He used the weekly meetings of this body to craft, review, and approve policies. In his 8 years in office, the NSC met 366 times, and Eisenhower was present at 329 of those meetings, a 90% attendance rate. It is easy to lampoon this bureaucratic drudgery, but for Eisenhower, good government required such constant focus. "Plans are worthless, but planning is everything," he often remarked. "If you haven't been planning, you can't start to work, intelligently at least." In the hour of crisis, Ike wanted a disciplined, well-trained staff and system already in place, ready to work. Discipline carried over into Eisenhower's approach to the economy and defense. A champion of the free market, Ike told Americans that prosperity would come only to those who worked hard and made sacrifices. The government would do no more than clear a path so that individual Americans could demonstrate their God-given talents. It is no accident that Eisenhower's closest friends were self-made millionaires who, like him, had started out in life with little. He also told Americans they needed discipline to wage and win the Cold War. From his first inaugural to his farewell address, he insisted that to prevail in the struggle against global communism, Americans needed to demonstrate vigilance and steadfast purpose. They needed to pay taxes, serve in the military, and rally to the defense of their country. They needed to spend wisely on defense so as not to jeopardize the health of the economy or trigger inflation. Most significant, he believed, the American system could endure only if citizens willingly imposed self-discipline and prepared themselves to bear the common burden of defending free government. Americans like to think of themselves as the inheritors of Athenian democracy, but Eisenhower, a soldier statesman who believed his nation faced a dire threat from a hostile ideology, also drew inspiration from the martial virtues of Sparta. Ike's insistence on vigilance, discipline, restraint, and individual self-reliance sometimes worked against him politically. He was never comfortable in the role of a purely partisan leader. He did have strong views on many issues, and he presented himself at election time as a conservative, small-government, budget-balancing Republican. But he considered the president a national leader above the partisan fracas. This tendency to leave the job of party politics to others got him in trouble. In the elections of 1954, 1956, and 1958, Republicans lost 68 seats in the House and 17 seats in the Senate. And Eisenhower had no good answer for this implosion. When Democrats attacked him from late 1957 on for his alleged lapses on a series of issues, from national defense to economic growth and social programs, Eisenhower failed to mount an effective partisan rebuttal to these charges. In 1960, Senator John Kennedy got a jump start in the presidential campaign, running against the allegedly cold and complacent Republican Party, and nimbly raced to victory. Yet one of the reasons Americans admired Eisenhower was his indifference to narrow party advantage. The voters put Democrats in charge of Congress. They loved Eisenhower. He garnered an astonishing average approval rating of 65% during his 8 years in office, higher than Ronald Reagan, 53%, or Bill Clinton, 55%. More striking, Eisenhower found support in both parties. Over 8 years, 50% of Democrats approved of his performance. In our more polarized times, such cross-party affinity is rare. On average, only 23% of Democrats approved of George W. Bush during his 8 years in office, while a mere 14% of Republicans offered their approval of Barack Obama during his 2 terms. Eisenhower had that rarest of gifts in politics. He brought Americans together. And so we come back to that scene on the deck of the Williamsburg, depicted so movingly by Captain Beach, a scene filled with pathos and deep humanity, and in a way the perfect metaphor for the age of Eisenhower. There sat the most powerful man in the world, relaxed in a circle of wounded soldiers, men who had given so much for their country, men who would never be whole again. It was a moment of quiet intimacy, a gathering of brothers. "I know these men," Ike had said. These kindred spirits felt bound to one another, not by their desire for power or their yearning for material rewards or their partisan affiliation. Instead, these men formed a family because of their belief in the ennobling act of personal sacrifice and public service. In their midst, Ike drew their attention not to the benefits they could now expect from their government, but to the additional role they must play as exemplars of the American spirit. Nothing could more perfectly capture the hopes and the enduring appeal of the age of Eisenhower. Part 1. Duty. Chapter 1. Ascent. The homely old saw had proved to be true. In the United States, any boy can grow up to be president. 1. No president had ever had so little experience of politics and so little first-hand experience of American life as Dwight D. Eisenhower, asserted the veteran political journalist Marquis Childs in his 1958 book, The Captive Hero. And many critics echoed this claim. After a long career in the protective, isolated world of the American military, including lengthy postings overseas in Panama, the Philippines, and Europe, Eisenhower, upon taking office as president, knew little about the basic rhythms of ordinary American life and was unschooled in the ways of politics. True, Eisenhower had spent his adult life in the hierarchical, rule-bound world of the Army, and he'd never been elected to anything in his life. But Childs was doubly wrong. Eisenhower was intimately familiar with the nature of rural American life, having been raised by God-fearing, dutiful, and frugal parents in the Kansas farmlands, and he left Kansas at the age of 20 to enter upon a career in the most political of institutions, the U.S. Army, in which he rose, over many years of patient labor, to a position of preeminence. His humble origins and his extensive leadership experience were the twin sources of Eisenhower's popular appeal and his political success. He had deep roots in Middle America, of which he remained proud and by which he set his moral compass. At the same time, he learned how to operate in and finally dominate a massive bureaucracy filled with ambitious egos hungry for glory. As Gary Wills memorably wrote, Eisenhower made his ascent to power by climbing a slippery ladder of bayonets. Not only did he achieve greatness in the American armed services, during the Second World War he asserted control over the British Army as well, forging its fractious, skeptical generals into a cohesive fighting force alongside the Americans. Together, and under his command, they defeated the Germans. His leadership of the combined Allied armies in Western Europe required vision, patience, compromise, goodwill, and inexhaustible persistence, precisely the skills that prepared him for the White House. As chief of staff of the U.S. Army just after the war, he faced huge problems of winding down the national military establishment while retooling for a global Cold War. For 4 years, he was president of Columbia University, where he navigated the complexities of academia. And in his final post before winning the presidency as Supreme Commander of NATO, he directed 12 nations toward the common goal of mutual defense and rearmament. Far from being inexperienced upon taking office in 1952, Eisenhower could reasonably look upon the presidency as a job for which he was extraordinarily well prepared. Far more so, certainly, than his predecessor, Harry S. Truman, had been upon taking office after Franklin D. Roosevelt's sudden death, and certainly more than his 43-year-old successor, John F. Kennedy, the junior senator from Massachusetts. Expressing supreme confidence in himself, Eisenhower jotted down this remarkable observation at the end of his first day in the Oval Office. Plenty of worries and difficult problems, but such has been my position for a long time. The result is that this just seems, today, like a continuation of all we've been doing since July 1941, even before that. It is hard to imagine a man with a stronger sense of himself and his origins, and a man as tested by war, the burdens of command, and the politics of world leadership as was Dwight D. Eisenhower on the day he took office as the 34th President of the United States. 2. There was nothing inevitable in this ascent. Eisenhower's forebears had emigrated from the Susquehanna Valley of Pennsylvania to Abilene, Kansas in 1878. They formed part of a colony of prosperous Mennonites who were searching for a new start in the wide open plains of the West. The family patriarch, Jacob Eisenhower, a minister of the River Brethren Church, saw opportunity in Kansas and desired greater distance from the influence of modernity that was starting to encroach upon the plain people of south-central Pennsylvania. In Abilene, Jacob bought hundreds of acres of rich farmland, built a large homestead with ample room for gatherings of his church flock, and settled into a life of farming and worship. Jacob's son, David Eisenhower, not drawn to the rigors of a life on the land, hoped to establish himself in business. He spent a year at Lane University in Lecompton, Kansas, improving himself, learning Greek, and studying mechanics. At Lane, he also met a pretty young woman whose family hailed from Virginia, Ida Elizabeth Stover. The two were married in the Lane University chapel in September 1885. David went into the dry goods business in the nearby town of Hope. For 2 years, the store succeeded and David and Ida began to raise a family. But David lost interest in the store and moved his family to Texas in search of a new start. He found work in the small town of Denison, just south of the Red River and the Oklahoma state line. Denison had been established only 20 years earlier and was little more than a huddle of buildings surrounding the intersection of rail lines on the Missouri-Kansas-Texas Railroad. Far from home and penniless, David and Ida had a third son, born on October 14th, 1890. They named him David Dwight, and he was brought into the world in a rented home facing the railroad tracks in an isolated rural Texas town, as far from the halls of power as an American could be at the turn of the century. David, Ida, and their three boys could endure the heat and the limited prospects of Denison for only 2 years. In early 1891, they moved back to Abilene, where David was embraced by the extended Eisenhower clan and employed as a mechanic by the large Bell Springs Creamery, a dairy processing plant owned and operated by members of the Brethren Church community. Cautious about spending money, David had raised his family in modest and at times difficult circumstances. Combining hard work with a devout faith, he and Ida built a stable and happy life, though they always lived close to the margins and never knew financial security. Abilene was a small frontier town with a population in 1892 of about 5,000. It had been settled by cattlemen in the 1850s to serve as the end point of the Chisholm Trail, along which millions of cattle were driven from ranches in Texas to stockyards and railheads in the heart of the country. Despite an early reputation as a town of loose morals and dangerous gunslingers, Wild Bill Hickok served as the sheriff in 1871, Abilene, by the turn of the century, had settled down to become a quiet mid-American small town, with a main street of handsome Victorian homes and a downtown of a few dozen brick buildings running north from the train depot and stockyards. No longer a rough outpost, Abilene then had 14 churches, 4 schools, paved main streets, a theater, 2 daily and 4 weekly newspapers, and was home to the Dickinson County Courthouse. The community valued modesty, piety, plain speaking, and family. Townspeople shared the view that hard work was a duty, as well as proof of a person's worth. The Eisenhowers lived in a small, white-clabbered, 2-story home at 201 Southeast 4th Street, with tall, narrow windows and a slender ribbon of porch running along the front. The home sat on a 3-acre parcel just a block south of the main rail line that marked a frontier of sorts. Eisenhower's family lived on the wrong side of the tracks and would have had limited social interaction with the more affluent families. David's job at the creamery demanded long hours, 6 days a week. Stern, religious, and diffident, David was the breadwinner, Supreme Court, and Lord High Executioner of the family, his son later recalled. Ida provided quite a contrast. Vivacious, intellectually curious, and clever, her 1 year of college at Lane, almost unheard of among women in Kansas in the late 19th century, revealed her passion for learning. This she passed on to her 6 boys, to whom she dedicated her life. But the Eisenhower household was no bevy of free thinkers. As parents, David and Ida were disciplinarians, and family life revolved around work and Bible study. "Everybody I knew went to church," Eisenhower remembered. Social life was centered around the churches, and in the Eisenhower family that meant close association with the Mennonite River Brethren community and its intense devotions. Every evening the family gathered in the small living room to listen as David read out loud from the family Bible. Later in life, Ida and David both became Jehovah's Witnesses, a sect devoted to Bible study, evangelism, and pacifism. Eisenhower knew his scripture, yet it is noteworthy that after leaving home for the Army, he did not attend church until 1953, when he joined the National Presbyterian Church in Washington and was baptized there at the age of 62. Eisenhower was the 3rd son, and known affectionately as Little Ike. His larger older brother, Edgar, was Big Ike. Arthur, Edgar, Dwight, Roy, Earl, and Milton, another brother, Paul, died in infancy, shared 2 bedrooms. Eisenhower shared a bed with Roy. They all became successful in their chosen fields, the youngest, Milton, becoming one of the country's leading academic administrators. A president of Kansas State University, Penn State, and Johns Hopkins, Milton served as Eisenhower's closest and most intimate personal advisor for the duration of his presidency. The boys shared in the manual labor of the household, whether working in the vegetable gardens, doing chores, or attending to the animals the family kept in a barn. Eisenhower spent summer weekends selling homegrown vegetables from a cart he pulled up and down the residential streets, earning the family a few additional cents. In these early years, Eisenhower turned in an average performance in school, intensely competitive and a gifted athlete. Strong, agile, and quick, he ran with a group of Southside boys, defending the honor of his neighborhood against the wealthier and socially more prominent lads from north of the tracks. He bloodied a few noses in frequent scraps and developed prowess in boxing. He grew to a height of 5 feet 10 inches, tall for the time, and sported a shock of blonde hair. Throughout his life, he loved to be outdoors. His relationship with nature had nothing of the masculine self-improvement hyperbole of Theodore Roosevelt or Robert Baden Powell, 2 leading figures of the day then urging teenage boys to pursue the strenuous life as a way to build character. Eisenhower was simply a country boy who, when not working or in school, spent the happiest moments of his youth fishing, hunting, camping, or playing in the breezy vastness of the plains or along the banks of the shallow Smoky Hill River. Like any boy who has grown up in the country, he always felt cooped up inside, and as president he yearned to get into the open air, whether on the golf course or on occasional fishing and hunting trips with friends. Eisenhower never tried to hide his humble country origins behind the accumulated honors of his stunningly successful career. "The life we had together," he wrote, "had been complete, stimulating, and informative, with opportunity available to us for the asking. We had been poor, but one of the glories of America at the time was that we didn't know it. It was a good, secure, small-town life, and that we wanted for luxuries didn't occur to any of us." After he finished high school, Eisenhower went to work in the creamery alongside his father, a job he held for nearly 2 years. But this was not a fulfilling life for a smart, quietly ambitious young man. He wanted to go to college, inspired by his brother Edgar, who matriculated at the University of Michigan in 1909. Edgar's tuition was paid for in part by Eisenhower's wages at the creamery. The boys agreed that after a year they would switch places, with the older boy working to put the younger through a year at Ann Arbor. But Eisenhower was too impatient to wait for this long-term plan to unfold. In his 20th year, urged on by his friend Edward Everett Swede Hazlitt, Jr., who was planning to attend the Naval Academy, Eisenhower sought and gained admission to the U.S. Military Academy at West Point. He enrolled in June 1911, aged 20 years and 8 months. Here was his ticket out and up, into a world he could never have glimpsed from Abilene. 3. He could not have known it at the time, but Eisenhower entered West Point at a propitious moment. In the coming 3 decades, his class of 1915 provided many of the general officers for a rapidly expanding U.S. Army that would wage 2 world wars and grow into the most powerful military the world had ever seen. Of the 164 men who graduated in his class, 59 would rise to the rank of brigadier general or higher. Eisenhower and his friend and classmate Omar Bradley both attained the exalted rank of General of the Army, a 5-star general. In time, their class was aptly named the Class the Stars Fell On. This rise to stardom, however, took a long time. For all his later glory, Eisenhower did not distinguish himself at West Point. He struggled with the Academy's obsessive attitude toward discipline and rules, though he persevered. His years of manual labor in Abilene prepared him for the rigors of cadet training. Life at West Point, Eisenhower thought, was hardest on those who were not used to exercise or who had been overindulged. But he confessed to a lack of motivation in almost everything other than athletics. His one true passion, football, occupied most of his time. It would be difficult to overemphasize the importance that I attached to participation in sports, he later wrote. And yet this was a pleasure denied to him after suffering a knee injury in 1912, his second year at the Academy. Though his playing days were over, he became a cheerleader for the football team, then the coach of the junior varsity squad. He showed great talent as a motivator and student of the game. He was inclined later in life to see football as a great school for leadership. Perhaps more than any other sport, football tends to instill in men the feeling that victory comes through hard, almost slavish, work, team play, self-confidence. His knee injury nearly cost him a commission in the Army, but he had gained a reputation as a natural leader, despite his average academic performance. He graduated 61st in his class in June 1915, and in September received a commission as a second lieutenant in the U.S. Army, along with 3 months back pay and orders to report to Fort Sam Houston in San Antonio, Texas. The fates now conspired to deny Eisenhower the one thing that every officer silently yearns for to spur his advancement up the ranks: war. When he left West Point, his timing seemed perfect for a combat command. In 1915, the year Eisenhower received his commission, a German submarine sank the British passenger liner Lusitania, killing 128 Americans and putting America and Germany on a course toward war. After further provocations from Germany, President Woodrow Wilson asked Congress for a declaration of war in April 1917, the start of America's 30-year confrontation with German militarism. For Eisenhower, the outbreak of war promised action, combat, and promotion. But when war came, he did not go to France. He went to Fort Oglethorpe in Georgia to train officer candidates. He yearned for orders that would get him into the war, and they seemed in the offing when he was posted to Camp Meade in Maryland, there to train an engineering battalion. But Eisenhower's organizational abilities had been noted, and instead of being shipped to Europe, he went to Camp Colt in Gettysburg in the spring of 1918, where he was tasked with building a new tank corps. Rather than face the trials of the battlefield, he confronted the arduous duty of transforming a derelict outpost in the Pennsylvania countryside into a major training ground for men destined to be shipped to France. "Now I really began to learn about responsibility," he recalled. He had to find tents for his men, equip these rudimentary quarters with stoves, fuels, bedding, and food, and develop a training program for a tank corps that as yet did not even have tanks. In midsummer, the camp received its first shipment of the new wonder weapons, 3 French-built Renaults, about 7 tons in weight, without guns. To train the men, Eisenhower laconically wrote, "We improvised." He became known as a rigid disciplinarian, but one who was fair and consistent. When he caught an officer cheating at cards, he had no doubts about what to do. The man was given a choice of immediate resignation or court-martial. More serious challenges came in September 1918, when Spanish influenza swept through the camp, leaving 175 men dead in just a week. Eisenhower now had to organize isolation tents, a hospital, a rotation of doctors, and a morgue. On his 28th birthday, Eisenhower was promoted to temporary lieutenant colonel, but his real present came the following month in orders to ship out to France. Too late. The German army was close to collapse, and on November 11th, the war came to an end. It was a bitter disappointment to him. "I had missed the boat in the war we had been told would end all wars. I was mad, disappointed, and resented the fact that the war had passed me by." What was to become of an army major, the rank to which he now reverted, without combat experience, in a peacetime army? His prospects were limited, but it is a testament to Eisenhower's talents that he rose even in these circumstances to a position of influence. Two factors worked for him: his own hard work and the support of some powerful patrons. His posting to Camp Meade led to an introduction made by a dashing aristocratic officer named George S. Patton, whom Eisenhower had befriended, to one of the most influential and respected men in the interwar army, Brigadier General Fox Connor. As operations officer for the American Expeditionary Force during the war, Connor had won a reputation as one of the Army's finest minds and most respected senior officers. Eisenhower and Connor developed a strong relationship based on mutual admiration, and Connor adopted Eisenhower as a protege. When Connor was sent to the Panama Canal Zone to command the 20th Infantry Brigade at Camp Gaillard and oversee the U.S. military presence in this new vital waterway, he got Eisenhower assigned to him as his executive officer. From January 1922 to September 1924, under Connor's command, Eisenhower burnished his reputation as a hard-driving, exacting officer who brooked no slouching from the men. When he was not working or shooting bats and insects out of his vine-covered quarters at Camp Gaillard, Eisenhower read texts assigned to him by the deep-thinking Connor. Under the general's guidance, Eisenhower sweated out the tropical evenings in his tin-roof barracks, devouring the classics of strategy, including Karl von Clausewitz's complex treatise on war, the memoirs of Napoleon, and campaign histories of the American Civil War. He even dove into Plato and Nietzsche, borrowing books from Connor's splendid personal library. After their daily duties were complete, the two spent many hours exchanging ideas and provocations about history, philosophy, and leadership. These sessions were invaluable to Eisenhower, and he later acknowledged Connor's enormous impact on his intellectual development. He was therefore supremely well prepared for the year-long course in strategic studies he took at the Command and General Staff School at Fort Leavenworth in 1925-26. At the end of the year, Eisenhower graduated first in his class. In July 1926, Eisenhower marked an important milestone: the 10th anniversary of his marriage to a slender, blue-eyed beauty named Mamie Geneva Dowd. He had fallen for her when he was just a year out of West Point, and she just 18. They met in San Antonio, where Mamie's well-to-do family spent part of the year. Her father had made a prosperous living in the meat processing industry and also owned a large home in Denver. Mamie and Eisenhower were married in the Dowd home in July 1916. It proved a wonderful match. Though they had few resources, Eisenhower's pay was paltry, and despite small subventions from Mamie's father, they lived in cramped officers' quarters for years. They were both outgoing and warm, a pair that collected friends and hosted parties with eager, unfeigned pleasure. "She was not technically beautiful," one portraitist wrote, Her nose was a millimeter too long, her mouth too generous, and her shining brown hair swirled down her high forehead in a curious, untamed style of her own. On the other hand, her long-lashed eyes were the dark blue of a piece of sky reflected in a well, and her skin actually seemed translucent. Though fragile-looking, she possessed the warm earthiness of the people of the western plains and mountains. She was restful to be with, yet her enthusiasm for life was expressed in constant movement, so that she rippled in the breeze of her own excitement. In Mamie, Eisenhower had found a vital partner, a woman of energy, charm, and sociability, who devoted herself to his career. Their happiness was touched by tragedy in the late winter of 1920, when their three-year-old son, Dowd Dwight, whom they had nicknamed Icky, contracted scarlet fever. The young couple had been amassing armfuls of Christmas presents and putting them under a spindly Christmas tree in their cramped Camp Meade quarters, but the gifts were to remain unwrapped. For by Christmas Day, Icky's condition had worsened, his fever soared, and he drifted in and out of consciousness. In the early hours of January 2nd, 1921, he died. Eisenhower's own words, written almost a half century later, captured his despair. "I do not know how others have felt when facing the same situation, but I have never known such a blow. Within a week, he was gone. I didn't know what to do. This was the greatest disappointment and disaster in my life, the one I have never been able to forget completely. Today, when I think of it, even now as I write of it, the keenness of our loss comes back to me as fresh and as terrible as it was in that long, dark day soon after Christmas, 1920. For a long time, Mamie would reveal many years later, it was as if a shining light had gone out in Ike's life. She, too, was shattered, as a plaintive letter to her parents written 3 weeks after Icky's death reveals. "I find the hardest time is when I go to bed and I can't tuck him in. And the many times I think I hear him in the night." Not until August 1922, with the birth of their son John, did the Eisenhower family begin to feel whole again. But every year, on Icky's birthday, Eisenhower sent Mamie a bouquet of roses. The Connor connection that had taken Eisenhower to Panama continued to open doors. Connor secured for Eisenhower a position working for General John Black Jack Pershing, the commander of American forces in the First World War, who by 1927 was directing the American Battle Monuments Commission. This organization erected cemeteries and monuments across Western Europe to memorialize and honor America's fallen servicemen, and Pershing asked Eisenhower to prepare its official guidebook. This job gave him the opportunity to work with the Army's most senior officer and to earn a glowing commendation letter from Pershing that referred to Eisenhower's superior ability and unusual intelligence. He also made the acquaintance of a man whose name he had often heard praised by General Connor, Colonel George C. Marshall, whose star was on the rise. After further academic training at the Army War College in Washington, D.C., from whose year-long course he graduated first in his class in 1928, Eisenhower went to Paris to continue his work for Pershing's Battle Monuments Commission. It was a heavenly 14 months for Eisenhower, Mamie, and young John. They lived in an apartment on the Rue d'Auteuil in the western part of the city near the Bois de Boulogne. Eisenhower and Mamie entertained often, drawing on the large American community in Paris for social company. They half-heartedly studied a little French and spent a good deal of time on the road visiting military cemeteries and monuments on behalf of the commission. One memorable holiday junket with Major William Gruber and his wife Helen in late summer of 1929 took them through Belgium, Germany, and Switzerland, traveling in a rented Buick, drinking plenty of wine along the way, staying in country hotels and picnicking on the roadside. They especially enjoyed the Rhine Valley. Eisenhower found the countryside of Bonn, Koblenz, Heidelberg, and Konstanz gorgeous, with its vistas of pine woods, hills, and castles. The couple was entranced, he noted in his journal of the trip, by the people as well as beautiful landscapes. Everywhere they went, they were met with courtesy and kindness. "We like Germany," he gushed. Eisenhower could not know it then, but he would return to these same lovely landscapes 15 years later as the commander of a gigantic armed force set upon destruction and conquest. 4.